what we may be seeing is the first macro nonlinear shift in a major feature of the global climate as a result of human-induced climate change. This is a flint. The area above the Arctic Circle represents about 9% of the total area of the surface of the planet above the equator. You change that from a highly reflective surface to a highly absorptive surface, and you start changing the energy balance for a significant portion of the planet. And that affects things like the jet streams, storm tracks, and potentially food production in places a long way away. In the last year, there have been two jaw-dropping developments for climate scientists, where you could literally hear the intake of their breath around the world if you were following the conversations. The first was what happened in the Arctic this past summer. That was a shocker for everybody. The second is what I'm going to show you right now.
That's Thomas Homer Dixon, scientist and best-selling author. This is Radio EcoShock, and of course, I'm your host, Alex Smith. But I'm going to step right out of the way. Here comes the shocking new science replacing the already outdated 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thomas Homer Dixon spoke with seasoned journalist Ross Gelbspan at the Vic EnviroFest 2008. It was March 20th in Toronto, Canada. The hall was charged with student energy. The question was, who, if not us? Here is Thomas Homer Dixon.
What I thought I'd do this evening is, in my half hour, spend 15, 20 minutes or so going through some of the latest science, especially from the last year and a half or so, that's not reflected in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that came out last year. In fact, the guillotine on submission of scientific evidence and research to the IPCC process came down around mid-2005. So a lot has happened since then. In fact, a surge of scientific findings have come forward from a lot of different sources, a lot of different research programs that bear in extremely urgent and serious ways on the climate change situation. In fact, I'd say that what we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years is a significant shift in the perspective of climate scientists, from regarding climate change as a matter of serious concern, deep concern even, to now a matter of grave urgency. And that despair that Ross spoke about is palpable in the climate science community. I was at a geoengineering workshop, actually, in November at Harvard. Some of the top American climate scientists were there, about 30 people. There were two Canadians. I was one of them. And the reason, as you pointed out, the reason that they're starting to think about geoengineering now is because we're going fast in exactly the wrong direction in terms of our carbon emissions globally. And so they're saying mitigation isn't working. We're not cutting carbon emissions. We have to start thinking about Plan B. Plan B may be pumping millions of tons of sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere of this planet to try to reduce the amount of solar radiation coming to the Earth. Now, every single one of those scientists recognized that this is a staggering gamble with the future of the biosphere, that there may be untold unexpected consequences and things could go horribly awry. But if Greenland starts to melt and we're looking at a 5-meter sea level rise or more, perhaps over an extended period of time, then people may start demanding around the world geoengineering. The concern that I have just on this geoengineering issue very quickly is that in 20 or 25 years, when you're about my age, geoengineering is liable to be on the table because there don't seem to be many alternatives at that point. Now, I think we still do have some choices, but they're rapidly dwindling. So I want to give you a sense for some of this climate science. I'm going to fly. I'm going to go fast, and then I'm going to say a few words to reinforce what Ross was talking about in terms of the seriousness of the coming social transitions we're going to make, the kinds of social disruptions that are likely to occur, and what especially young people can do. And then we'll have an interesting conversation, I hope. What you're looking at here are NASA data for 2007. This is a map of the world showing climate or heating anomalies against a baseline of temperatures from 1951 to 1980, so that's the average that you use. And across the bottom, you can see the warming from 3.5 to 4 degrees Celsius. This is 2007, so this is the second warmest, tied for the second warmest year on record. And you notice that there's very substantial warming in the north, and that's something that I will come back to in a few minutes. It's a very important point. This is a long-term trend line for temperature increases, mean a global surface temperature, going back to 1880 across the bottom up to 2007. The Earth's climate is chaotic. From year to year, it varies around the trend quite substantially. It's that chaos, that chaotic response is largely driven by what are called ENSO events, El Niño Southern Oscillation events, which is a kind of sloshing of water and heat back and forth in the southern Pacific Ocean that affects climate around the planet. When you have an El Niño event, you tend to get warmer temperatures when you globally. When you have a La Niña event, as we have right now, you tend to get cooler temperatures. 1998 was El Niño of as large as any we've seen in the last century. We're now in a La Niña phase, which is why we're getting a cold winter this winter with a considerable amount of snow in much of the world and cold temperatures. One of the things that you're going to see, and you are hearing out there in the blogosphere and among the climate skeptics right now, is the claim that global warming has stopped. What they do is they look at the last cluster of points, and they draw a straight line through them. Now, any of you who have taken statistics knows that that is somewhat illicit. You know, you choose your data points, you can draw straight lines all over the place here, and it's essentially meaningless. Climate is a long-term phenomenon, and it's a result of averaging over many years. We happen to be in a La Niña situation. We happen to be at a solar minimum in terms of the amount of radiation coming from the sun. There are no sunspots on the sun right now, which means that there's less, about a third of a watt per square meter on the surface of the planet, less solar radiation. And so temperatures are a bit cooler. It's likely that solar cycle will kick in again and we'll start seeing an increase in solar radiation, and we're probably going to flip in the next year or so back to El Niño, the El Niño part of the cycle. And the expectation is that about 2010, 2011, we'll see temperatures higher than the record in 1998. If we're looking out to the future using IPCC estimates, which are now probably conservative, the scenario that is of particular concern, or the one that is often used to sort of business as usual, is this one called A1B. This is a scenario representing a certain population size for the human population, certain kinds of technologies, certain energy usage rates, certain trade between rich countries and poor countries. A1B is considered a mid-range business as usual scenario. Across the bottom, we're looking from 0 degrees Celsius to 8 degrees Celsius. These are the range of temperatures that we get from 2020 to 29. A little bit difficult to see here. This is 2090 to 2099 within the lifespan of your children. We're looking at increases in temperature. Again, this is conservative. Within Canada, of up here, 3 to 4 degrees Celsius in much of the habited part of Canada, 5 degrees in northern Canada, and 6 degrees Celsius or more in the Arctic. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude, the total warming of the planet since the coldest period of the last ice age, 15,000 years ago, is 5 degrees Celsius. This is a very rapid change. In fact, we're going to drive, in this century, the temperature of the planet, the average temperature of the planet, higher than it was during the last interglacial period, 125,000 years ago. And in that last interglacial, about two-thirds to three-quarters of the Greenland ice cap melted, and sea levels were 4 to 6 meters higher than they are right now. Now, that's a long-term process, that melting, but we seem to see things happening in the Arctic right now that are of particular concern. This is a map of Arctic ice from the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. This is pretty close to the sea ice minimum this past September, 9th of September 2007. That's the actual extent of sea ice in the Arctic. The magenta line represents the average extent of sea ice from the period 1979 to 2000. So compared to that average, we lost about a third of the sea ice this past summer. And if we want to compare it to the 1950s average, we're down about 50%. These, again, are National Snow and Ice Center data. What we're looking at here are across the bottom from 1978 to 2007. Here is millions of square kilometers of sea ice in the Arctic. Each dot represents the minimum extent, usually about mid-September, of sea ice. You can see that they've regressed the line down here and found a pretty steady trend. The key thing to notice, of course, is what happened in 2007. It's unclear. We only have 1 year of data. But that change wasn't expected, according to the models, for another 25 to 30 years. The IPCC said that we would lose all the sea ice in summer in the Arctic probably around 2060, 2070, 2080. A year and a half ago, based on what was happening just in the last couple of years, scientists were saying 2040 or so. Now they're starting to say we'll see complete disappearance of the sea ice in the Arctic by around 2015 or maybe earlier. What we may be seeing is the first macro, nonlinear shift in a major feature of the global climate as a result of human-induced climate change. This is a flip, right? You've probably heard about the possibility of climates flipping. And what we're seeing, perhaps, is a flip in what's called the cryosphere, which is the system of ice at both ends of the planet, the North Pole and the South Pole. You might say, well, what does it matter? This is ice. It's a long way away from us. It's what, you know, a bunch of polar bears are going to drown. It doesn't really matter that much. And I get that response a lot. But above the Arctic Circle, the area above the Arctic Circle represents about 9% of the total area of the surface of the planet above the equator. You change that from a highly reflective surface to a highly absorptive surface, and you start changing the energy balance for a significant portion of the planet. And that affects things like the jet streams, storm tracks, and potentially food production in places a long way away. This is a very serious matter. When people talk about melting the sea ice in the Arctic, and they start talking about things like, you know, losing polar bears, or you know, gee, we're going to have fights over whether we can get freighters through the Arctic, and we're going to be exploring for gas and getting into fights with other countries over exploring for natural gas and oil. Believe me, if we lose the sea ice in the Arctic, we're going to be thinking about a lot of other things besides property rights in the Arctic. Another thing that's been noticed over the last few years is that what's happening in the ice caps, especially Greenland and Antarctica, seems to be much more dramatic than was expected. The IPCC suggested that we would see 20 to 60 centimeters of sea level rise this century. A lot of people breathed a sigh of relief. Oh, that's not too bad. We can just build our seawalls a little bit higher. It turns out, though, that the IPCC models of melting of the Greenland ice cap and the Antarctic ice cap were what are called static models. Basically, they assume that the atmosphere would warm, you get melting on the surface of the Greenland ice cap or Antarctica, the water would run off the surface and down into the oceans. It turns out now we understand that the process of melting of these ice caps is dynamic. Among other things, there are cracks in these glaciers and ice fields. The water that pools on the surface because of the melting runs down those cracks. Here's one of them in the Greenland ice cap. They're called moulins, M-O-U-L-I-N-S. There are tens of thousands of them now. And that water runs down in huge quantities, millions of tons of water, to the bottom of the ice sheets and lubricates the flow of those ice sheets down into the ocean. So they start moving a lot faster. It also takes huge amounts of heat down to the bottom of the ice sheets, so you get melting from both the top and the bottom. This is a phenomenon that was not fully understood until a few years ago. In some sense, it's not even fully understood now. To give you a sense of the magnitude of water we're talking about in these ice caps, if you melt all of Greenland, you get 7 meters sea level rise. You melt the West Antarctic ice sheet, you get another 5 meters. Those two are considered particularly vulnerable. You melt all of Antarctica, you get 50 meters. In total, you have about 70 meters of water in those ice caps. But it's West Antarctic and Greenland that are particularly important. What are you hearing from climate scientists now? They're saying at least a meter this century, and quite possibly 2 meters. And James Hansen recently published a paper suggesting it could be up to 5 meters this century. He says there are very clear historical records of sea level. Once it gets going, once these ice fields and ice caps and glaciers start to melt, of sea level rising by a meter every 20 years. Now, you get 2 meters this century. Let's assume that we're not looking at the worst case, but you're looking at something like 2 meters. You're starting to talk about major infrastructural damage, significant population relocation away from coastlands, and very significant important cities that will no longer be inhabitable. That's all within, in terms of the human experience, a very short period of time. The last point I want to make in terms of the science I'm introducing is something about energy, because the energy and climate issues are incredibly closely associated and integrated now, and you can't really disentangle them effectively. We need to understand that in the world right now, we're going through a transition, and Ross alluded to this, from a petroleum age to a post-petroleum age. We are not running out of oil, but we're running out of cheap oil, oil that is easily accessible, oil that takes relatively little energy to get hold of. This is a photograph of an oil rig I worked on in northern Alberta, BC, in the 1970s. And just quickly to give you a sense for the kind of transition we're going through and why it's virtually inevitable. Here we have a graph of oil production and oil discovery globally. Going back here to 1900, on this axis we have up to 60 billion barrels of oil equivalent. The lighter line is oil discovery, peaking at around 60 billion barrels in 1964 and then declining, with a reversal here as a result of the discovery of the Alaskan North Slope oil fields and the North Sea fields in Europe. Here you have steady increase in production and consumption, driven now at about a rate of 2 to 3% a year, largely by industrialization in China and India. And then, of course, you notice this gap right here, which is extraordinary. On an annual basis, we're consuming around 30 billion barrels of oil globally, and we're discovering somewhere between 3 and 5 billion barrels of oil. We can't do that indefinitely. Sooner or later, we can do it for a while now because we're tapping these earlier resources, but sooner or later, this curve is going to peak and start to decline. You've probably heard that referenced as peak oil theory. This is not, again, about oil running out. It's about cheap oil becoming less and less available. Basically, what's happening in the world is that oil companies are having to go further into more hostile environments to drill deeper to find smaller pools of lower quality oil. It's taking more energy to get energy. And that's a concept that specialists refer to as the energy return on investment, EROI. In the 1930s in Texas, oilmen who were drilling for oil then would get about 100 barrels of oil back for every barrel of oil of energy they invested to drill down into the ground and pump oil out. So their EROI, their energy return on investment, was about 100 to 1. In the United States now, for conventional oil, it's around 17 to 1. The energy return on investment for the tar sands, regarded by many Americans as the fallback energy resource for America in a world of scarce conventional oil, is about 4 to 1. The energy return on investment for biofuels, for corn ethanol, is 1 to 1. You put about as much energy in as you get out. As you slide down that slope from 100 to 1 to 17 to 1 to 4 to 1 towards 1 to 1, looking at the aggregate of your whole economy, you're using more and more capital and wealth, a larger fraction of the capital and wealth in your economy, simply to produce energy, and you've got less left over for everything else you need to do, including solve your really difficult problems like climate change. Now, make no mistake, climate change is going to take a lot of energy to address. If we get things like that sea level rise I was talking about, we're going to have to rebuild coastal infrastructure, move populations away from coastlines. Because of changes in hydrological cycles, we're going to have to drill deeper for water, move water from newly wet areas to newly dry areas, desalinize water along coastlines. We're going to be pumping billions of tons of carbon dioxide underground. All of that is going to take a lot of energy. Just at the time, we're going through an energy transition from a world of abundant, cheap energy, high-quality energy, to one of, at best, mixed-quality energy, a lot of which is much more expensive than we've experienced up to this point. This is a chart of comparative EROIs of fuel systems, and it represents something extremely important. Here we, let me just... For those of you who might have some trouble reading, I'll just show you what you're looking at here. This is crude oil. Remember I said for the United States it's around 17 to 1. For the world it's around 20 to 1. Here we have corn ethanol around 1 to 1. Oil shale, which is the same as the tar sands essentially, is around 3 to 1, 4 to 1. Coal liquefaction, that's turning coal into diesel fuel. Terrible technology, really dirty in terms of carbon output. It gives you an EROI of around 2 to 1. But look at this. Coal gives you an EROI of 80 to 1. The punchline here is that as the energy return on investment for oil falls and oil becomes more and more expensive, now at $100 a barrel or so, and it's going to probably continue to stay high despite an evident recession in the United States, as oil has become more expensive, we've seen a shifting of fuel sources for firms and for economies away from petroleum, in particular oil, towards coal. So you've seen what I would call a recarbonization of the global fuel supply. This is a very important shift in an underlying trend in the human energy trajectory, if you want to call it that. Looking back over a period of a century and a half, there's been a steady decarbonization of the human energy system. As we've gone from, in the 18th and 19th centuries, from wood as our principal fuel source, and then to coal, and then to oil, and more recently natural gas as a major energy source. With each one of those shifts, we've released progressively less carbon dioxide into the environment for every unit of energy we've produced. Now we're turning that trend around, and we're starting to release more carbon into the atmosphere for every unit of energy produced. This is a very fundamental shift that's occurred just in the last half dozen years. And we can see this shift in terms of the latest figures on carbon emissions for the planet as a whole. In the last year, there have been two jaw-dropping developments for climate scientists, where you could literally hear the intake of their breath around the world if you were following the conversations. The first was what happened in the Arctic this past summer. That was a shocker for everybody. The second is what I'm going to show you right now. First of all, just a little bit of background. Here we have a bunch of 8 IPCC scenarios, B2, B1, A2. There's the A1B we talked about before. The A1F1 scenario is the most pessimistic scenario. Across the bottom from 1990 to 2010. And here, in terms of billions of tons, gigatons of carbon, or billions of tons per year of carbon emissions around the world from 5 billion to 10 billion tons. In the background, you see these smooth curves. These are the emission scenarios used by the IPCC from 1990 to 2010. Laid over the top are two actual emissions measurements from two different systems or two different methods. And that's what we saw until 2005 or so. And this is what we've seen this last October. These statistics for 2006 were released. That's 2006 there. Came in at 8.4 billion tons. That's half a billion tons above the worst case IPCC estimate. And this is what is driving climate scientists to start talking about geoengineering. As cockeyed an idea as that may be, which it is in many respects, it is out of as Ross was suggesting, a sense of despair about the trend. We are not making any progress on mitigation. We're not cutting our carbon emissions. We're going in exactly the opposite direction. So, what do we do? I agree with Ross that we are looking at probably a time marked by considerable crisis in the future. Because this isn't the only thing we're dealing with. It may be perhaps the most significant, but there are a lot of other profound and potentially destabilizing stresses developing on the planet, not the least of which is the energy problem I talked about. This convergence of stresses, and by the way, research shows that societies don't do well when they're being hit by multiple shocks simultaneously or multiple stresses simultaneously, and that's what we're doing at the global level now. This convergence of stresses is probably going to produce various kinds of breakdown in the future, social, economic, ecological, political breakdown. It's impossible to say exactly what it's going to look like. It's possible we're seeing the beginnings of one right now with the global credit crisis. But we do know that we live in extremely tightly coupled global political, ecological, and economic systems, technological systems now. Shocks tend to propagate from one side of the globe to another very quickly, as we're seeing again with the credit crisis or with the spread of something like SARS. And certainly that would be the case if, for instance, there were a significant food shortfall on the planet. Every person would be affected because we're all linked together now. But I don't think that that prospect of a time of turbulence and volatility and crisis in the future is the end of the story. I think it might actually in some ways be the beginning of the story. It might be when things get really interesting. Because we do know that human beings are at their most creative and inventive and sometimes at least, pull together best to solve their problems in times of crisis. Times of crisis are what I call moments of contingency. There are times when a society can be pushed potentially in a positive direction or a negative direction, maybe with just a gentle nudge or the right decision maker doing the right thing at the right time. Times when people are angry and frustrated and looking for answers, want to do something, often looking for somebody to blame. These are exactly the times that the great Irish poet W.B. Yeats was talking about in his famous poem, The Second Coming, which he wrote shortly after the Russian Revolution, where he said, "When things fall apart, the worst are full of passionate intensity, and the best lack all conviction." Well, he's absolutely right. He sort of divided the world into two categories, extremists and non-extremists. When a crisis occurs, extremists tend to know what to do. They're networked together. They often have resources set aside. They're ready to go. And they often know who to blame, too. Non-extremists, perhaps those of us in this room here, we can assume we are, non-extremists are often in crisis wandering around saying, "Oh dear, what are we going to do now? This is really bad." If there's any fundamental point I'm trying to make in my book, my most recent book and with many of my arguments now, is that if we want to make sure that when a crisis occurs in the future, that we can, in that moment of contingency, push things in a positive direction, we need to start thinking now and preparing now about what we're going to do then. And in this respect, I think Ross and I are on exactly the same page. The time for that kind of proactive mobilization, networking, scenario development, and thinking about the future is now. And I hate to say it, to a very significant extent, it falls to you. Now, that doesn't mean that people like Ross and I aren't going to be involved very directly. But the mobilization challenge, in many respects, is yours. Now, this is something I've had a lot of trouble understanding. And maybe it can be one of the issues that we talk about over the next few minutes. But it's your future that's melting in the Arctic. This is a calamitous development, unlike anything that's really been faced by humankind before. This is bigger than many, if not all, of the social challenges and political challenges that humankind has faced before, and ecological challenges. And it's something that we have the wherewithal to do something about. You know, it's like that old $6 million man line. We have the technology. This is a matter of will. And the will has to be expressed democratically. And I'll know that we're getting somewhere when we see millions of people in the streets saying, "Do something about this problem." And it has to be the people who are most fundamentally connected and have the most fundamental interest in the future. And that's young people, and it's mothers with kids. Now, you might think that this is hopeless pie-in-the-sky stuff, but let me tell you a story. In the early 1960s, mothers discovered that their breast milk was contaminated with strontium-90, a radioactive isotope that had bioaccumulated in mammals, including cows, and all the milk in the stores was similarly contaminated because of atmospheric tests of nuclear weapons. And it turned out scientists did the research and turned out that what was basically happening here is this was producing an elevated risk for leukemia in all children that were fed this milk. So mothers were basically poisoning their kids. They mobilized themselves. They got together. They organized themselves across national boundaries. Hundreds of thousands of mothers in North America and Europe and in the Soviet Union. And within 2 years, they had the partial test ban treaty and they moved nuclear testing underground. Now, it wasn't a perfect solution, but it made a big difference. It was probably the first big nuclear arms control agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union. And it's significantly achieved by popular mobilization of people with a concern about the future. Okay, let's paint an optimistic scenario before I sit down about what might happen over the next couple of years. The first thing that's got to happen is scientists need to get off the stick and start being really clear about how serious the situation is. They're spending too much time saying, well, you know, this is what the balance of evidence looks like, and we're pretty concerned, but it's all ending up in kind of scientific journals. People like James Hansen is now saying, this culture of scientific reticence is not something we can afford anymore. Scientists have to be out there, and they have to start politically mobilizing. There are examples of that happening in the past that were very effective. The second thing that needs to happen will be dependent upon the results of the American election. But I can tell you, no matter which of the three candidates is elected, we are going to have a radically different climate policy in Washington, probably within 2 months of the inauguration. Why? Because every one of them is very explicitly committed, including McCain, very explicitly committed to a climate policy of some kind. The first thing that should be done is the president, him or her, should go, or he or she should go to Beijing to talk to the Chinese. The Chinese and the Americans between them account for about 40 to 50% of world carbon dioxide emissions. If you get the Chinese and the Americans, the Canadians, the Europeans, the Japanese, and a few others, maybe eight around the table, you actually have a reasonably tractable negotiation problem. And you probably have about 80% or more of world carbon emissions. That's the team, that's the group that you need to make the deal. And what are you looking for? You're looking for a global regime for carbon trading and for carbon pricing. You've got to get a price on carbon emissions. We need a price on carbon emissions of between $50 and $100 a ton. You're not going to get there right away, but we need to get there pretty fast. And I'll tell you, you start pricing carbon emissions like that, and you get the forces of capitalism, the forces of entrepreneurship focusing on this problem, and the whole world will change from top to bottom. Because people, entrepreneurs around the world, will be looking for every kilogram of carbon they can keep out of the atmosphere because they'll make money from it. Now, it may sound a little bit strange. I just want to get back to this last point about mobilization. It may sound a little bit strange that millions of young people and students and mothers should be in the streets around the world demanding that we have a global carbon trading regime, but that's what we need, and we need it as fast as possible. It doesn't sound like a particularly sexy thing to mobilize around, but that's the real McCoy. That's what we've got to do. If I were the king of the world, and sometimes I get asked this question, if there were one change I'd make, it would be get in place a verifiable, enforced, financially backed global carbon trading emissions regime, carbon emissions trading regime. In the meantime, just to conclude, there's a job for young people to do, and that's the job of developing your networks and mobilizing to provide the political support for courageous political leaders who will have to go out and make the deal with the special interests and the energy interests that Ross so eloquently talked about. It's going to be much harder for them to do it in a vacuum, but if there is demonstrated political support, broadly based political support that's active and vocal, again, in the sense metaphorically in the streets, then it's going to be a lot easier for politicians to do the right thing. Now, we actually have a kind of serendipitous development on this planet right now. At the very time when humankind faces perhaps the most serious challenges it's ever faced in its history, we happen to have in place a rudimentary technological infrastructure for species-wide democracy. And it's called the Internet. Now, right at the moment, it's really nothing more, for the most part, than a venue for a kind of cacophony of narcissism. Everybody's blogging at each other and bullying each other and retreating into their Facebook communities, and you know whom I'm talking about, right? But it has incredible potential, and we've exploited perhaps 1% of the possibility. Now, the trick here, and this is going to be the subject of my next book, the trick is trying to make people smarter collectively than they are as individuals. Smarter than the sum of the individuals in the group. What tends to happen with human beings most of the time is that the larger and larger the group, the more stupidly we behave. Up to the level of the whole planet, the population of the whole planet, we've got about as much intelligence as a protozoan in a petri dish. You know, we're gobbling up all our resources and pooping up the petri dish. But if you look in certain places and certain kinds of human behaviors, and markets sometimes exemplify this very well, but other things too, you find that sometimes human beings can be a lot smarter collectively than they are as individuals. And one of the places where you see this is in the open source phenomenon. Now, just a quick riff on open source and I'll conclude. If somebody had said 10 years ago, we're going to make an encyclopedia. This encyclopedia is going to have 4 million entries. It's going to be internet-based. The culture of participation in this project will be voluntary, collaborative, and for the most part, people will leave their egos at the door. We're going to run this project for a while, and for, you know, say a period of 6 years or so. Any person can make any change they want to any entry, any time, from anywhere in the world. And after 6 years, we're going to bring in a bunch of experts from the science journal Nature to take a look at the science entries, and they're going to determine that the science entries are about as good as the Encyclopedia Britannica's. 10 years ago, if you'd said that that was going to happen, you would have been laughed out of the room. But there it is. It's called Wikipedia, and we use it all the time. You know, just about every time I turn to Wikipedia, I'm really impressed by how good it is, considering that it is a product, in a sense, of a voluntaristic movement and, in some sense, of almost an anarchistic process of problem solving. Now, I know there are lots of caveats and problems with the open source and with Wikipedia in particular, but I would hazard a guess that the open source phenomenon may turn out to be the most important social development of the last century. Now, I'd like to see what can be done with some of the things we've learned about open source by using it to help us solve some of our other bigger problems besides developing encyclopedias. Some of the challenges we face here, planning for the future, dealing with our energy problems and our climate problems, developing essentially what I would call open architecture democratic practice, creating global agoras for mobilization of people and problem solving, not just 1,000 or 10,000 people coming together, but 1 million, 10 million, or even hundreds of millions of people involved in collective, complex problem solving. Now, this is not a trivial problem to solve, as they used to say in my graduate student days at MIT. The devil is in the details and how you structure something like this. But of all the things I look at around the world, all the possible routes to solving this problem, all the possible routes to mobilizing the kinds of political support and movement that we need to solve the climate change problem, this is the one ultimately that sounds most plausible to me. And we can all start in our own ways individually in creating that mobilization effort and creating those networks and developing our plans for the future tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Wow, even I am shocked. Thomas Homer Dixon was speaking at the Vic and Firo Fest 2008 in Toronto, Canada on March 20th. We owe this important recording to a regular EcoShock listener, John Paul Warren in Toronto. I talked with John Paul by email about the need for a Toronto posse to record speeches like this one. There is a London posse, a small group of people who make it their passion to record socially important speeches. Los Angeles has a posse, and there are a couple of us here in Vancouver who give up evenings buying our own equipment to capture the message of our times. I encourage you to do the same in your locale. While I can't guarantee a broadcast on Radio EcoShock, we can certainly share quality green audio via our website. Just send an email to me using this address, radio@ecoshock.org. Let's use the net to keep up with climate change, peak oil, and the clean solutions that might save the future. Let's network. radio@ecoshock.org. Find out more about Thomas Homer Dixon at www.homerdixon.com. There is a dash in his last name, but not in that web address, just homerdixon, all one word, .com. His most famous books are The Ingenuity Gap and The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. He writes often for the New York Times and the Toronto Globe and Mail newspapers. You will find a listing of his scholarly articles at his website, plus podcasts of his appearances and interviews. You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. Download top speeches and green audio for your computer or iPod at our website, ecoshock.org.